This is a spoilers alert. There are some sections of this interview with Kazuo Ishiguro which might give things away to people who are in the midst of reading the book, so proceed with caution. Thank you.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm really honestly thrilled to have as my guest a writer that I've been speaking with book by book for many years. It's Kazuo Ishiguro, as he is called, Ish. Although he has won the Nobel Prize and has interviews coming out his ears, he's very generously given us a Bookworm interview. He's with us today about his book, Clara and the Sun. And I want to begin by telling my listeners that I loved this book, that as far as I was concerned, it was like a Christmas present. And as far as my producer is concerned, it is like a Christmas movie. It's a book that I think ultimately is about whether the nature of love can continue after the arrival of robots, or as they're called in this book, artificial friends. Can they replace human beings? Can they replace, for a mother, her dying daughter? For the daughter, her loss of the presence of her father, while this young girl whose name is Josie is in bed with her artificial friend, can she experience loving care? And Ish, they've been talking about this book as being a book about the encroachment of the mechanical. I feel it's a book about our modern threat to love. It's really a book about the possible disappearance of love. And I wanted to know, if you would mind, what the book is for you.
I think you express it very well there. It doesn't exclude some of the other things that people have said about it. You know, people are talking about the backdrop to the book, which does involve a world in which artificial intelligence is very every day. You know, so Clara is a robot, and she's nobody remarks about her presence. I mean, it's as common as having a bicycle or a vacuum cleaner or something. But at the heart of the story is that I think you're right. It's about love. It's about human relationships. What does it do to a notion, that the notion we have about love? And perhaps in particular, I am interested in, and I think Clara is interested in, as this creature that's dropped down in the middle of this human world that she's learning about. You know, the question is there something actually special about each individual person? Is there something like a soul inside each of these bodies that makes sense of human love? So that there's some meaning to saying, I love this person, but I don't really love that person. You know, I hate that person. And in a world in which algorithms and artificial intelligence is almost invading our sense of the uniqueness of each individual. Yeah, what's it going to do to the way we look at each other? If you can really map out someone's personality, I mean, are we at the stage where we can actually map out and code and algorithms somebody's wishes, their impulses, their deepest desires, to the point where you start to doubt whether there is anything unique about each individual, whether we've just been going along on some hangover from some past age when we had different kinds of beliefs about God and the soul and so on.
The book is narrated by Clara. She is run by solar power, and so as the title tells us, she has a special relationship to the sun. And the title of the book is Clara and the Sun, and it's published by Knopf. And as a result, since she has gone off on her own to a remote place with her human friend, that friend's mother, there's one house nearby where what might be her boyfriend, a man that Josie has planned a lifetime relationship of love and presumably marriage. That's the only other house that is inhabited in the neighborhood. This is not a book with outside detail. It's completely focused. You are centering on the small group of people and the ways in which they reveal the arrival of a mechanical substitution culture. I have to say that I found Clara very moving, because in seeking the sun, it's as if saying, we all need a God of some kind, no matter how we find him, no matter how we may self-create him. Clara talks to the source of her power. She talks to the sun. And these are very meaningful talks, because eventually she's imploring, she's begging the sun to provide the healing, the nourishing energy, which will save her human, Josie, save her and bring her back fully to life. Now, is the creation of a God part of the subject of this book?
I'm not sure whether Clara ever actually thinks of the sun as a God. I don't know if she has that idea. It's perfectly logical from her point of view, because she's solar powered. And you know, she doesn't actually bring very much baggage with her when she arrives in this book. And she's almost like a tabula rasa. You know, she's not even like someone from a different planet, right? And so this is a very interesting kind of narrator for me, because normally when I have a narrator, they're haunted by their past and their history. But she comes like a completely kind of fresh thing, almost like a baby. Because she is solar powered and all the other artificial friends she's in the store with at the beginning are all benefiting from the sun, and without the sun, they can't be nourished. She has this idea that everything important and good and protective comes from this very kind presence, which is the sun. And when she looks out into the human world, out of the shop window at the street outside, I mean, that's the way it looks to her about humans as well. It looks like humans need the sun. They smile when the sun shines in shafts of light through the buildings and so on. And so it makes absolute sense for her. I don't think she ever articulates it in terms of a religion. You know, it never, her belief in the, it's more like a belief that, and a faith that there is something good and protective watching over her all the time. And she never loses that. And the other thing that she, other small piece of kind of baggage that she brings with her is this business about loneliness. She knows that she has been created to stop teenagers from becoming lonely. If there's some sort of version of a religious instinct in the way I portray Clara's relationship to the sun, it's missing all that stuff about politics and power and manipulation that really tends to go with religion as we know it.
It made me actually weep several times. She has a place that she decides she has to go to talk to the sun. She has to be in a certain position, she believes. When her first prayers do not work, she regards it as possibly the result of an inappropriate address to the sun. She has made a promise to the sun that she will help. This is amazing, Casual. It's such a parable. That she will arrange to stop pollution. And she goes out and uses some of her own life fluid to take a machine that makes pollution and prevent it from working, only to discover that having destroyed, immobilized this machine, well, it wasn't the only one. There's yet another one. The mother in this book is considering, if her daughter dies, can she create a mechanical version? She's already lost one daughter. And so I think, horrifyingly, she attempts to invent a substitution. In certain ways, that's what this book is questioning. Not only what is individual about each character, but are we capable of losing the human? What is the human to you? What does that mean?
Well, that's a big question. But I think what you're saying there about the mother is really very interesting. The big question is, can her feelings towards her daughter actually stretch to actually include somebody that she is told is like an exact copy? I guess that's what we're asking here. Has our understanding of the world altered to the point where we can convince ourselves that it is possible to make a copy? Not even a copy. That, you know, in the old days, you know, when we used to make cassette tape copies from our vinyl albums, you know, we'll think, well, that's a copy, but it's not as good as having the real album. I mean, at least that's how I always used to think. But now we are told that, you know, as soon as we came into the digital age, we were told that a copy isn't really a copy. It's literally the same thing again. You know, there's no difference. And as a concept, you have to do away with this idea of an inferior copy of a superior original. And I guess the mother is kind of starting to entertain in her desperation, because she so wants to avoid the bereavement, the unbelievable pain of losing a second child. She's at least entertaining this possibility that her emotions, her traditional human emotions, could now stretch to actually believe that it is now possible to have not a copy of her daughter, but a continuation of the daughter, even after she physically dies, because we have the ability to more or less map out everything about Josie that made her Josie. You know, we have the technology to do it. And when people are maybe desperate enough, when they love somebody enough, and when they fear the loss of that person enough, and we live in this kind of world, I wondered, well, how far could their emotions go? Could human love actually stretch to do that? Or would it just seem like a piece of gross self-deception? And so that mother is, she doesn't know herself. And she's accused of being too traditional at one point. Somebody who is still in the enthralled by the superstitions of an earlier era, an earlier age, a more religious or more credulous age. But now we know better, and maybe we have to open ourselves to the idea that there are no souls inside human bodies, and given enough data and given enough technology, that that uniqueness can be replicated and continued.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to KCRW's Bookworm. I'm talking with Kazuo Ishiguro about his new book, Clara and the Sun. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Kazuo Ishiguro about his new book, Clara and the Sun, a finely tailored vision of a future both imagined and inevitable, a glimpse inside the circuitry of human consciousness and an appreciation of nature as the engine of life. Now, one of the things, Ish, that struck me, the child, the first child, Josie's older sister, was named Sal, and Josie is named Josie. And this seemed to me, this book, you'll pardon me, I'm a reader, and this book seemed to me to talk to me in all of its details. As I've grown up, parents who named their daughters with names that were potentially boys' names, Sal and Joe, were parents who still wanted a boy. So we begin this book with the potential that these children that we're reading about, talking about saving, were not wanted in the form they came to begin with, and that the mother and potentially the father wanted a boy. This is no longer part of our human consciousness. I don't know parents who are hoping for a boy rather than a girl. They're hoping for a living, healthy child who will grow up healthy and happy and strong. But it felt like in the background of these parents was the desire for a male child. Did that occur to you?
Oh, to be frank, Michael, no, it didn't. I mean, I'm a parent to a daughter, and I always wanted a daughter, and I was glad when it was a daughter. But I think you're right to highlight the theme of parental ambition, because the thing we haven't talked about, we've been talking about artificial intelligence and data, big data and stuff. The other major thing that's going on in the book is gene editing. And parents, this is a world in which parents have to make a decision. They don't just worry about whether their kids are going to get like a privileged education or not, and whether they're in a position to provide their children with a privileged education so that they can compete in the kind of meritocracy out there. It's become much more harsh than that. They have to make a decision about whether to have their child benefit from gene editing. And of course, many parents wouldn't be in a position to even contemplate that, either because of their financial circumstances or their social circumstances. But anyway, that's the situation we have. And the two teenagers that are living out there in this remote part of America that you described. I mean, one of them has been gene edited and the other one hasn't. And they seem to love each other. And we don't know, because teenagers, you never quite know whether their love is one that can last. But certainly in the way that young teenagers do, they're very devoted to each other. But they're divided by this border. And so that question about parental ambition, I mean, in the world of Clara and the Sun, it was important for me that giving your child the benefits of gene editing, which would actually mean that they are they have better cognitive powers, and that they will be seen to be people who could actually occupy the privileged echelons of society. It actually carries a medical risk, and in a small percentage of cases, it has a health risk, and that's parents have this dilemma, even if they're in the position to give their children the benefits of being lifted, as people call it in the book, you run that risk. I guess it reflects my concern that we're very close to a world in which much more objective distinctions are being dangled in front of us in terms of what we can and can't do to our children.
Well, I have to tell you that for me, the thrill of this book is that we learn things like this as Clara learns them. And so we see this world essentially through an innocent's eyes, and we learn about it step by step, and the difference between my response and Clara's response, I felt a growing sense of ominousness and horror that is not available to Clara until much later, as we watch this robot develop human emotions like empathy, understanding, sympathy, and even love. And in this book, we're watching not just the AFs, the artificial friends, cast aside and substituted, but we're watching this happen to human beings. Is an ex-husband substitutable by a new husband? What are the possibilities that a second marriage between two humans will be better than the first? And both of the mothers in this book wonder about that question. And as it happens, the teenager in the book who has not been lifted demonstrates abilities that come naturally to him as a young, unlifted human being, and his work is appreciated, his drawings, his diagrams for machines, by people capable of judgment who see his work, and yet somehow he chooses not to accept the lifted status of his natural abilities. That's a choice too, isn't it, in this book?
Yes, I suppose it is. I mean, I guess he becomes resigned to this kind of caste system. I mean, he has potential, he has talent, but it's difficult in the world as it's developing, the society that's developing in this book. I think Rick accepts and is resigned to the fact that, talented as he is, naturally talented as he is at the work that he does and the passion he has for it, that the way the society has been organized will not give him the opportunities to develop his talents in the conventional way. I think he accepts that. And so that, you know, by the end of the book, although we know that he has a lot of talents, the fact that he hasn't been lifted really makes him this kind of lower caste figure. So he's got to follow a path that somehow justifies his talents, but in some sort of alternative way. I mean, I understood it that, yeah, he was making almost like underworld contacts where his expertise and his inventiveness will be appreciated. But he's had all the paths to the universities and the good positions that will allow him to develop his talents. I mean, all those things have been shut to him. And he kind of, I guess like a lot of characters in my books, he doesn't rebel against that. He seems to accept it. And he does his best. At the end of the book, he's still confident and he's still spirited. He knows that these doors have been closed to him.
At the end of the book, we are virtually left alone with the narrator, with Clara. She is an artificial friend who no longer has a human friend. She's in the equivalent of an old age home for artificial friends. We even get to see her with the woman who was her store manager, who comes and inadvertently finds her on a visit. I felt if the subject, part of the subject of the book, is loneliness, I felt a loneliness at the end of this book that moved me to tears. Let me say, Ish, that I loved this book. I loved reading it. I'm afraid I approach it with more innocent eyes. I approach it with Clara's eyes, and I loved reading a book that I could enjoy terrifically as it educated me about its world. It was a thrill to read, and I thank you, Ish, for joining me today.
Well, thank you, Michael. And it's fantastic to be able to talk about the book at this level, at the emotional human level.
I adore your writing. I think that The Unconsoled is one of the very greatest books of our time. I live in the joyous expectation of whatever it is you do next. This book, which comes after you won the Nobel Prize, I couldn't wait for it. It was an immediate thing for me. And you'll pardon me, although our talk has been very thoughtful, the book filled me with excitement and joy. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Michael. And it's great to do this again with you.
I want to tell my listeners that due to the pandemic, we are each taping remotely, so you may hear unusual sounds. In our case today, garbage trucks. Visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show. Also available at Apple, Spotify, and all other podcast services. You can even listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. Special thanks to my dear show collaborators, Alan Howard and Sean Sullivan, engineer Desmond Taylor, and technical director PJ Shahamat. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.